One of the main things that I discovered was it's going to be my response and where I respond from that whether or not it heals me or not is going to determine my experience.
Welcome to Wealthy, Wealthy Life, the podcast dedicated to busting age-old myths that are preventing you from becoming wealthy, healthy, and happy. I'd like to introduce your host, award-winning entrepreneur, best-selling financial author, and avid health enthusiast, Christina Weiss.
Hello and welcome back. This month, I'm launching my next podcast series, this one on cancer. 8 months ago, I wouldn't have thought I'd be researching cancer, but in March, my father was diagnosed with a stage 4 sarcoma and was given only a few months to live. This series was inspired by my desire to find unconventional cancer perspectives and protocols to try to extend my dad's life. I recently lost my father. It was too late for him, but I hope what you learn out of my conversations with these extraordinary thought leaders on the cutting edge of cancer treatment and prevention can potentially extend or save the life of someone you know or love. Each week, I'll be releasing an exclusive interview where we debunk some of the biggest myths around cancer and discuss alternative theories and treatments that mainstream medicine isn't talking about. Enjoy.
Robert, what an honor to be on this call, video, whatever we call these things anymore today. Just this conversation, I've really been looking forward to it. And thank you, first of all, for sending me a couple of your books. You're obviously an author of many books, but I could probably ask you so many questions. But one of the first things I wanted to talk to you about is that I've been doing this podcast, which is Cancer Series, and those that have been listening to this cancer series know that my father was diagnosed with cancer about 6 months ago. He was given 3 months to live, and he just passed a couple weeks ago after he made it about 7 months. So, and we had a great time those 7 months. It was, we really squeezed as much time together in as we could. But during that period, I really researched cancer, like why cancer, what is cancer, how is it that this horrible disease had never really affected my life before. Yeah. And a book that I read really in that process of trying to understand and cope with it, deal with it for myself and help my father if I could, there was a book called Radical Remissions. And I just found it was fascinating. This book is like all these stage 4 cancer survivors that had just beat all the odds when the doctor said, "This is terminal, game over," at most maybe 12 months, but sometimes a matter of weeks or months. And you're in that book.
Oh, I didn't know that I was. I know I had published an article on their website, but I didn't know I was in a book.
You've dealt with cancer and you've heard the C word and you've conquered it. And then you've turned, kind of, I think we'll talk about that, okay. But just how you've used the C word and how you've written books and how you have this amazing life and so philosophical and spiritual and, you're just living life and kicking ass. And so, I want to know what's underneath all this stuff.
Well, let me just enjoy some of the characterizations. Okay. Yes. Cancer. Very quickly, big brush. In December of 2011, I was in Australia, where I had lived for 6 years. I had actually, a few months before that, I'd moved back to the States, but I had a retreat in Bali that I was leading, so I went there. But some of the back pain that I'd been experiencing, diagnosed as disc pain or a spinal thing or something, got so bad in Bali that I knew I couldn't even fly back to the States where I had just moved. So I went back to Australia. It's a lot closer. Couldn't walk, and then decided I better go to a hospital. Something's really wrong. So I did. And then on Christmas Eve, 2011, after a number of tests, six doctors came to my room at a hospital in the Gold Coast and, Australia, with the scan, they showed me the x-rays and everything else and the reports from a biopsy. And they said, "Well, Robert, sorry to say that you have stage 4 lung cancer. While the primary tumor in your lung isn't that large, it has metastasized. and your spine, hips, and lower pelvis are riddled with tumors that we're afraid your spine is actually going to collapse because there's hardly any bone left. Its tumors have eaten it away. And statistically, you have 6, maybe 9 months to live. There's absolutely nothing we can do. And then they left. So that's how it all began. I came back to the States a few weeks later, being actually more concerned that my spine was going to collapse and I would be irreversibly paralyzed than whatever the cancer might implicate. So I came back and I had needed to find a place to live and didn't have insurance here. And so, you know, the whole, everything suddenly begins. And what that means is different for different people according to their circumstances. I had to find a place to live. By then I couldn't walk, so I needed to be near someone that could help me. I had to figure out insurance, find a doctor, you know, get oriented to this new chapter in life. And so I did. And the first thing is that when the word went out, I was inundated with really lovely, well-meaning letters, emails, calls, and so on of concern and support. And everyone recommended something. So as you know, being close to your father, as soon as you get the diagnosis, I think it's fair to say for everyone, you're a little disoriented, at least for a while, until you can get your bearings. So I was very open, which I generally am, but very open to all of these things that ranged from people you've interviewed for, why is it escaping my brain, but medical marijuana.
Right.
To psychic surgery, to clinics in Germany and Sweden, to alien interventions, to, juicing. And while I was trying to get my bearings, this tsunami of information that literally went from, you know, juicing to communication with alien beings, I realized, mother of God, this is going to kill me just by itself. You know, I didn't have a team of researchers to track all this down. And I was suddenly getting so confused, so overwhelmed that I just said, you know, no, thank you right now. And I did what I have been doing since I was a teenager, or actually younger. I turned within and I said, I need silence. I need to get really deep into myself, listen to myself, not spurn people with expertise that I don't have. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a healer of any kind. But in terms of finding your response, which to me is really important, what is, whatever the diagnosis is, cancer or anything, one of the main things that I discovered was it's going to be my response and where I respond from that whether or not it heals me or not is going to determine my experience, right? Which is why we meditate, for example. So I decided I needed to disconnect from outside and go within, which is what I did. I ended up doing some chemo. I'd had radiation in Australia. But when I made that move from outside and healing and fighting cancer and surviving, and I just said, I'm just not going to go down that path. However much time I may have, 9 months or 30 years, I'm going to do what I've always done, but more accelerated, which is, what the hell is true in the deepest part of my being? That's what I'm going to focus on. And that's what I do.
So it's a couple of things you said there. You know, one thing I think with my father, and he died a week before he turned 80, and we're hoping he'd make it his 80th. But
that would be nice.
But, yeah. You know, and I think a lot of it perhaps is just generational, his age and that generation, maybe, I don't know. But he really, part of, even when I was doing the research, I was really wanting to help, and I had access to all these incredible healers and doctors and those that I interviewed throughout this cancer series, even though we couldn't help my father. Part of what I was hoping is this research that I'd done and interviews I'd had maybe could help somebody else in the future. To your point, try to distill down some of all the stuff that's out there.
Sure.
Because you do. I said, Dad has cancer. I got bombarded with so many recommendations just like you from one extreme to the other, you know? So I totally know what you're talking about. I'm like, yeah, the aliens was in there too, but
I had someone very quickly, so I did, and I'm not belittling or making fun of anything or anyone. It was all legitimate, but so one woman, a metaphysician friend of mine, called and said, "Robert, I know a woman who can pull all of your cancer cells out of your body over the phone with a psychic intervention with the help of alien beings. And it's X number of dollars. I want to buy that for you. And your cancer will be gone in one phone call." You know, I didn't, right. Why not? Right. I didn't want to, you know, reject her. So I did. But I'm not sure that actually did anything. But at any rate, it's good.
Right, exactly. So anyway, I know what yeah. you're referring to.
Yeah.
The thing, I think the big, you know, thing with my father, that one, perhaps is generational, but two, perhaps it's a little bit even cultural, is that there's this idea of the doctor has the answers. Mm. The doctor will fix me. The doctor, if I do the chemo or do this or do that, then maybe I'll survive this. And I really saw that with my dad, that everything, whether I live or die will really depend what the doctor says next week when we get the chemo report back. Well, you know, the doctor said I shouldn't, you know, that it doesn't matter what I eat. I can eat any crap food. As long as I eat it, it'll be fine. As long as, you know, so his whole life, almost this end of his life, so much was dependent. I mean, or just really reactive or responsive to the next report for the doctor. So the opposite of what you're saying is that it was very outward versus going inward, just thinking the doctors or chemo or something may fix me. And what I think I hear you saying is, those were tools and different things, but ultimately I had to go inside. So what I'd love for you to do is describe, like, what do you mean when you say go inside? Like, what does that look like?
Well, it looks like me lying in my bed for 3 years. Okay. Can I comment on something you said very quickly?
Of course, yes.
Because it's so important. I've written about cancer. I've given some talks, but I'm not really, I haven't ever moved into the cancer world as, let's say, Anita Moorjani, who you may know of, who was literally in the process of dying, suddenly didn't, came back, and has written a couple of books and is a very beautiful speaker about what she's learned on the other side and stuff. I haven't really done that. So I don't like to speak as if I'm advising anyone in the cancer world in whatever way they are. I just wanted to say that. And one of the things that if someone were to ask me, what did I learn in the cancer journey that I would be willing to share, not as advice, but as a sharing, it's this, what you said. 100%, without question or doubt, the patient and his or her support team, family, but especially the patient, must always, and I'm mindful of these absolutes, maintain control of the decision-making process. You're the person who says yes or no to this, 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 or this. It's so essential. A very quick story to illustrate it. I have a really good oncologist. I don't want to give any more specifics because of the story I'm about to say. But he's really top-notch, lung cancer expert. I've been with him for 6 years. He really loves me a lot. We have a good friendship. You know, it's all there. But after about 2 or 3 years of when I was really sick and going through chemo and all that, I went in for a checkup and he says, "Robert, so how are you doing in life? Are you going out? Are you seeing someone? Are you back with, you know, goals that, you know, like what he thought of a full life was?" And I just said, no. And then he got a really concerned look and he took my hand, which he doesn't usually do. And he said, "Robert, you've been through so much trauma in over the few years, pain, this treatment, that, you're back." He goes, "It happens." And I said, "What?" He goes, "You're clinically depressed. You have no goals, you have no motivations, you're not going out, you're not engaged. I want to give you a low-level antidepressant. Take it for 3 months. It'll help you get over the hump." And I said, "Okay, Great. So he gave me the prescription. I go back 3 months later with my sister, who is my support team. And so he goes, so how are you doing? And I went, oh, my God. Thank you for giving me those pills. I mean, I am going, you know, I just painted this picture of a life he thought I should be having. Of course, I had to send my sister out of the room because she started cracking up so much. Well, not only did I not take the antidepressants, I never filled the prescription, because the life that he thought I should have, I have never had in my entire life.
That's hilarious.
You know, when I was 23 years old, I was living in India in an Indian ashram. When he was 23, he was headed to med school. We don't come from the same world.
Right.
But I knew he cared so much for me that. And then when I told him that I was really having this great life, he started to beam, and you know. So it's an example where doctors, however well-intentioned, as you know, and skilled and so on, they still come from their particular point of view. There were, I believe, 6 doctors in Australia who stood around my bed and said, there's nothing we can do, 9 months at the most, and let's hope your spine doesn't collapse. I might have outlived several of those doctors. I don't know. I'm not in touch with them. But what if I had absorbed as a reality, what am I going to do if 6 oncologists can't do anything and say, there's nothing we can do, you're going to die in a few months, go back and get ready? What if I just went, suck that in? Would I still be here? I doubt it.
Well, I think that's the case. And even that's what happened a big part with my dad, is we go into the first oncologist and I got a second opinion.
Good
but
for
the
you.
First oncologist said, 3 months to live and we're going to amputate your leg.
Oh, and, I know. I read that. So I heard that.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. But it was that, and dad just gave up. He went in, you know, he was hobbling around a little bit, but he was funny. His same old self. And he went from being a normal man to a sick man based on one diagnosis. And he never really recovered from that.
I know. And that to me is one of the things I will always say from my experience, that that's really, you know, be open and this and that, but you've got to do that because there is so much misinformation, even amongst the experts, you know. And I didn't know your father. I'm not 80 quite yet. I'm part of the older generation, but I'm still pretty open and so on. But, or cultural or generational, I think, you know, we're all pretty susceptible to the experts in our field, in real estate, in public speaking, in medicine, in religion. I mean, come on, no offense to anyone, but every religion is predicated on
the guru.
On the guru, the teacher, the scripture, whatever. And so one of the things that has been important to me throughout my life is that constant, ever-deepening connection to one's own deep self. And I think it's really important for people with, let's say, cancer or any catastrophic, unexpected intrusion in their life, where the first thing we want to do is safety, security, knowledge, you know, something. We reach out there and everyone's got something to say.
Yeah. And there's this tendency to want to abdicate our own health or life to the experts, the quote unquote experts, and not following our intuition, not really get in touch with ourselves. It's just handing our lives over, thinking because they're the expert, because they went to med school or whatever the case is. And you're a living example of, I had 6 doctors around me. They said I had 6 to 9 months. They said I was a dead man. They said I'll never walk again during those 9 months. And which you're still here how many years later, right? I mean, it was just
6 years. Yeah. Yeah. And one of the miracles along the way, which my current oncologist calls me his miracle patient, and has actually written about me in some articles, he said my whole spinal column, hips and pelvis, all the bones, it's all grown back. And he doesn't know how to explain
that. There's no answer. There's no explanation.
He cannot, from his point of view, the medical, he goes, Robert, I've never seen this. Your entire, all your bones that were threatening you, they've grown back. He goes, I don't know. So I was thinking, maybe take an antidepressant, you'll be okay. You know?
And so what was that magic? What is that miracle? When you say going it in, did it look like meditation? Was it journey?
Well,
I know we wanted to get back to that, but just how did you heal yourself? Obviously the first thing is you took responsibility. You went within.
Yeah.
You're realizing this is my journey. It's not their journey.
Yeah.
And I need to make the choices and I need to figure this out. And
correct.
And you obviously you went along that path.
All of which is true. However, I cannot claim that anything I did is why I'm still here. And I have no idea why I'm still here. My oncologist nobody knows. I'm happy with, I don't know. A lot of people aren't, so they invent something. I don't know. But the going within here, because I started meditating literally when I was in my teens, and spent 10 years with a meditation master in India, and been on that path for my whole life. When all of this external noise from people, friends, doctors, integrative oncologists versus allopathic, everything got too much, I did what some people might call meditation, mindfulness, contemplation. It's something that we all do in one way or another, which is, we take a deep breath and just bring our attention inward. Maybe we use a breath, some other technique, focusing thing, some kind of meditation, right? Where we do it sometimes spontaneously, we might put on some music and suddenly we're transported. We might take a walk along the beach and we're transported. It's really a way in which we connect to something bigger than our mind. And we do it, all of us, in many different ways, painting, the creative arts, of course, love, relationships, all of that. But rather than rely on a trigger, because it's something I've done for decades, I can just close my eyes or not, take a breath, put my attention on the breath. And when the breath goes all the way down at the bottom of the in-breath, that's where my attention stays. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a kind of, in Eastern spiritual terminology, it's a kind of samadhi or union where one's attention merges with what's currently called awareness or love, connection. However, there's different ways of coming at it, but we all know that. And so I used my decision to go deeper into myself to sort things out, to go deeper into myself than I've ever been. And I've been a meditator for a long time with a lot of experiences. I've written books, I've taught and so on. But there was something about, without believing the doctors, there was something that happened, which is the way I responded to the diagnosis and the prognosis was not to survive, was not to live longer, but was to finally, whether I have one day or 30 years, I'm going to get to the bottom of what my life path has been, which is, who am I? And so when I realized that I needed to get quiet, I thought, well, why don't I get more quiet and more inward than I've ever been in my entire life and not even make it be about cancer anymore? By then I had moved to where I am now, an apartment in Los Angeles. My sister lives next door. I had gotten some insurance. So, things were rolling along. And I said, well, why don't you just give yourself to silence and see where it takes you, that inward state, okay? And it took me. I have no conscious recollection of 2012, 13, and 14. You have to ask my sister, who's my chronicler of life. I don't remember what the fuck happened. Some force, something took my consciousness. And I wrote about it, I called Pony Rides to Oblivion, because meditation and various mystical experiences and so on, there is still a kind of residue of oneself. I feel connected. I feel joyous. I feel ecstatic. But where I went, where I was taken, there was no consciousness of anything. That's why I call it oblivion. For weeks and months, my sister would come over 20 times a day. I don't remember. Articles that I find on my hard drive today that I wrote then, I have no recollection. Right? I mean, like, I don't know. But when I would come back from one of these journeys and would sort of come to, if you like, I would notice things that were different than what I last remembered about who I was. And one of them was, I don't recall my history. I lost conscious connection to what my past was, experiences, memories, decisions. It was just like, I don't know whatever happened before. Loss of that. The other thing, interestingly, because I'm basically a speaker and a writer, is what I call the collapse of language. Because I live for months and months and months and months in oblivion with no language or interaction, self-talk or other, suddenly language as a medium of meaning. In other words, your father, bless him, believed in what the doctor said. So they just said a bunch of words, informed in some, but basically he believed the languaging. I don't believe anyone's languaging, including my own, anymore, because I don't live where language has its own meaning. You've got to go into language, right, as a defining reality in order to take it seriously, which is part of what meditation does. You used the word intuition a while ago. Well, intuition is pre-verbal.
It is. And when getting into your meditations, I guess you're right. I study language and I'm fascinated by language, and words have meanings and relationships are language. But you make such a good point. I've really never thought about that before. Someone that loves language is, when I do meditate or when that intuition, you're right. There is no language. You're right. There's no language.
No, honey. No. And if you were, let's say, you put yourself in that state, you were, you know, at a yoga retreat or whatever you do, you know, you're just absolutely merged, and someone comes up and starts laying a trip on you from a dogma, I guarantee you, you wouldn't even understand what they're saying. Like, excuse me? Because you're not in that reality. You're somewhere else.
Right.
Where you've got to figure out another way to experience, to communicate and to understand. It's like sketch comics. If you look at one of my great fetishes in life, improv sketch comedy troupes, one of the things that I noticed in watching this is no one there in the various, you know, games that they do, no one ever gets their feelings hurt. They never get insulted. You can't do anything wrong. You can't get, it's improv. It's just like you're grown-ups playing kids stuff. And there's something about that. I'm going, well, you know, I grew up in the Jewish faith. Not that I'm particularly Jewish, other than I complain a lot, but never mind. And so, you know, like, there's a black guy, there's a show I watch called Whose Line Is It Anyway? It's on TV. And there's a black guy, Wayne Brady, super talented, three white guys and other women guests that come there. And, you know, they'll go like, they'll tell racist jokes, gender jokes, oh my God, it's like the least political thing on TV. And then when you go to YouTube and watch the bloopers from that show, that the censors will come in and go, cut, cut, cut. Then you go, oh my God, that place is fucking out of control. Never mind what gets on. So I'm like, but wait a second, what is the position of their consciousness, their awareness relative to words, that when someone could come up to me on the show and go, Robert, you are a stupid, fat, old Jew, your hemorrhoids are bigger than your brains, you know, and I mean, I don't know. And what they then do is play off of that. is one of the principles of improv, you know, and right. There's no defensiveness. I'm like, well, that's so interesting.
That is so interesting.
What's going on in their consciousness related to language?
Yes.
You know, that all they do is laugh, crack up, or escalate it to the next part of the whatever it is that they come up with. I'm like, that's sort of what happened to me. I don't live where language in and of itself has any specific meaning, because like with the meditation we're talking about, once you leave conceptual awareness, I don't know your politics. I know you live in Texas. I've been there. You know, it's a little risky for me to bring this up, but here we go. Patriotism. Are you a patriot or not?
Am I? Yes.
Okay. Ask me if I am.
Are you a patriot?
I don't know what that means.
Oh.
What is it?
So let's talk about this. So I don't want to get too off in the weeds here, because this can be a
okay,
whole
which I do. Time. Sorry. Thank you.
But let me pull something okay. back, because sure. I'm fascinated by this. I mean, I really okay. even want to talk offline. But okay. the funny thing is, it's just the timing of it is that my significant other and I mean, we talk a lot about language and language in the sense of the meaning, but not, you know, but we have talked recently about, like, we live in these two realities. There's the one of the linguistic reality where we use words to coordinate, communicate, yes. share ideas, coordinate dinner, talk about our thoughts, or even try to use words to express our feelings to one another. And yeah. so language, but being very linguistic, even if there's a rub, to use language in a way that you don't attack the other person or criticize, but say, hey, something's not quite working, so can we language in a way to resolve this issue so that yes. we both feel better at the end of this? So we're like, you know, we're way into this, and, you know, it's kind of, we geek out on that a little bit because we're both very interested in language and creation and design life through language, like designing your life through language, basically. That most people is more that. Heideggerism versus objectivism and very philosophical. So there is that yeah. piece. It's very powerful. With that said, though, even as we went on this retreat, our relationship retreat and goal setting retreat this last weekend, and
nice.
And what we found was that, and he even said, you know, baby, I love you in both realities. And what he meant by that is the one, yeah, and it was great. So good, because there's one that. Reality where it's all yeah. language. And we love language, and we're very cognizant of our language and what words right. mean. So if you say a patriot, he and I would have the same definition, because we've discussed the definition of that. Okay. But the other reality is one where language, you can't express life in language. So the way I love him, or he loves me, or this place we go together sometimes in meditation, or either together or individually, it's this other place out there that has no language. And sometimes we get there, I get there alone, he gets there alone. So since we've both been there, we get what that place is. And occasionally we even get there together. So yeah. he said it this last time. He says, baby, I love you in both realities. And one is language and one is completely absent of language, where you can't explain through language because you're just so big. It's just so much more full of love and experience and something that's so far beyond. We don't have capacity to language it.
Yeah, I have to say, you'll see when you see the video, your face is just blowing right now, which is beautiful. I don't know your partner, but I love him, at least in the one world of language. I think he's great, and good for you. When I, in my work of public speaking, one of the things I emphasize before we start working on the content of the message or anything else in the delivery part, we get to, where are you speaking from? I'm not against PowerPoint. I'm not against talking point. You know, I'm still pretty improv based, but I do believe in preparation, organization, and so on. Statistics, you know, whatever, depending on who I'm working with. But what cuts across all of it, and what I think distinguishes the way I teach public speaking from everyone else, is I'm first asking, what is the opportunity of people coming together? Speaker, audience. Okay, but what is it, just to transmit information? Post it on a website, send them an email. You know, what is it really there? So for me, the primary opportunity is a kind of tribal, almost shamanic communal experience where I'm going to show you my humanity, and I want to speak to your humanity, and I want you to listen from your humanity. Or, with you and your partner, the place beyond language. Because then language will make infinitely more sense.
Yes.
If we're speaking from that place beyond language.
You just said it so well, yes.
And then you use language to represent, describe, teach what at some point is beyond language. But yes, it's doable with language if we speak from that place. I've been teaching public speaking for, I don't know, 15 years, whatever. And one of the reasons why it's so potent a vehicle for personal transformation, for growth and so on, is because the vulnerability of a person standing in front of others triggers almost every insecurity in the world. And Toastmasters and other places, no offense to them, but they'll give you a technique. Here's what you do. No, it doesn't free you. So when people are afraid, nervous, tense, anxious, they begin to speak from a fearful place in their mind, mm-hmm. right? It contracts us. And now we don't really know what we're doing with our body. We don't know where we are. We don't they don't have any awareness of what's happening. They just say something and then the talk is over. So I've ritualized the beginning as a principle I use. Before you start, you create a ritual that puts your attention in that place that you were talking so beautifully about. You've got to drop down there. Then you're open. Then you're unafraid. Then you connect. Then give your fucking talk. Show a PowerPoint. I don't care if you show it. Fine. I don't. But the whole thing that creates authentic connection is as valid in a giving a talk as between you and your partner. If you don't, he can come up, I'm assuming, so I think it is a he. Mm-hmm. Welcome to our age, we never know.
Right.
Well, it's actually an alien, but so your beautiful partner can come up to you and be thinking of something else and distracted and not present, not connecting, and go, babe, I love you, and you know that. And you're going to kind of go, really? Could you do that again? I'm not really feeling it. I heard you. Not really feeling it. Oh, yeah, okay, sorry, babe. Here, I really love you. You know I do. You're incredible, but I got to go. No. Eye contact won't make it. I need you to get to a place where you know what you're saying and imbue it with the awareness, attention, and love beyond language, and then tell me. I need you to get connected to yourself, then connected to me. And I'm sure he would, from what you said. But that sense of intimacy and authentic connection is as important in a real estate, whatever mm-hmm. you do. I've coached people from government to science, accountants. I did a training once for 125 accountants, all of whom had gray suits. And I'm thinking, the whole thing was about authentic connection to 125 accountants. They asked me back. It is a truth of human existence that truth between us, within ourselves and between us, in my view, originates from authentic connection. Connection to self, connection to other, then move into language. But don't ever break that connection. You've got to keep doing that. And so to me, it's the most efficacious strategy anywhere. Authentic connection. I don't care what industry, I don't care, what the content is. If we aren't connecting like that, stay in bed. Sorry. I told you in the beginning I wasn't going to go off on a long rant.
No.
There's so many things.
Yeah, well, I'm going to reply back to a few different things. One is that, I'm completing the cancer series, but on my next series I'm going to do is actually going to be a relationship series. So I'd mm-hmm. love to bring you back because I think there's a big conversation here on the language of love that's beyond, that's like to your point, beyond language. And I'm really excited about that conversation.
So you should bring your partner in too.
We will totally do that. We will. Yeah, let's do that.
Let's the three of us do it. Maybe I'll get a girlfriend by then. I'll bring her too.
Perfect. Perfect. So anyway, we're going to have that conversation because you're like one of the few people ever that I've talked about that I think I really get what you're saying. Because I'm trying to say that thing all the time, but it seems like nobody gets what I'm trying to say, you know, like what that place is and what do you mean beyond language and you know, what is authentic connection? I mean, people talk about authenticity all the time, but I'm not sure they know what it actually really means.
And fair enough.
So let's circle back though, just even to complete where, you know, you went to that place and that's place beyond language. And it sounds like 3 years of your life, you were going to that place and just by virtue of that and you use the words to get to the bottom of who I am. And it just became this going out there somewhere that maybe became part of this spiritual journey and healing. And just by virtue, it wasn't like you're trying to heal yourself. It's just the healing came out of you going to this place beyond language, beyond accepting what people were telling you, which was the method to cure cancer or extend your life. You were just so far beyond that.
Well, I was on a different path. I don't know if it was beyond it. I was different.
Yeah,
Well, I don't,
It's not beyond, like you're judging one better than the other.
Or it's a different thing. I listened to several of your podcasts after you invited me to speak with you. And there was one woman, I think she was maybe Pakistani or Indian. She does medical marijuana treatment. Mm-hmm. There. Mm-hmm. God bless that woman. You know, I reached out to her on Facebook. And I just listened to you talk with Christina. I'd like to be your friend. You're such a far out lady, you know, because of what she's doing. So I think there's room for everybody in all of this. Maybe if I were 30 years younger with a family, I would have put more emphasis on survival. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So there's too many variables. But, okay, here's a word I hate that I have to use. Surrender. People in any of the meditative arts sooner or later are going to come across this idea of surrender, which is you give yourself over to something. Okay. I don't want to say I surrendered to that silence because I couldn't. It was beyond anything I'd ever experienced. I didn't do it. I made the initial decision to go in that direction rather than try to survive. And it just started to escalate. And then I was taken. Mm. I was taken. I know that's all I can say to where I lost about 3 years. But wherever it is I was taken to, unlike all of my decades of spiritual practice, which would be I could achieve a certain state and then I would kind of come back, you know, and then I would have to go. What happened is I was taken to this place. And at a certain point, I never came back, and they dropped me there. And that's where I live now, all the time. By which I mean, in whatever way a listener of this show, Christina, wants to analogize something in their life, you were talking about it with your partner. Just go to a place, in whatever way you do, and we all do, where you have extraordinary peace, depth, silence, you know, however, connection, that whole place that is so euphoric, and then you come back. But now, what if you never came back and you live there? Mm. Effortlessly. That's just where you live. That's what happened.
Yeah, I love that. And
it's a default. I was interviewed, very quickly. Oh, Mike Gervais, the guy, when I got on notice from your office, it was that they had heard that interview. And one of the things I said there, because Mike is a high performance coach and does mindfulness. And I remember saying, imagine that mindfulness becomes the default state of consciousness, not a place you access, not a place you use. That's it. You're never not mindful. Mindfulness is the default state of your consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I know what it might sound like, and I'm very happy to get emails like, Robert, you're a spiritual egotist, whatever, but I now live there. End of story. I'm not saying it's self-realization or self-actualizations. you know, you can still call up my ex-wives and they'll say he's a fucking asshole. And I don't know what, you know. Okay. I also live there. So with respect to the beautiful way you talked about your partner saying, I love you in both places. And I swear to God, that's the sexiest and most romantic thing I've ever heard a guy say. I'm serious. It's fantastic. I love you in both. Usually most guys don't even know about the other place or this place. Okay. That's sexist. Never mind. but I can't love you there or here because the there and the here have lost their distinction as two different places. And now it's a continuum. Mm. It's a continuum, not better word, not beyond language or in language. That's like whenever you're confronted with two choices in language, other language, always choose the third, right? Language beyond language. Let's choose the third. What is that? Well, exactly.
Yeah. What is that?
You figure it out.
Exactly. Well, anyway, we could, I really want to go here. We'll talk more about this, sure. You know, in okay. your, the Living Sacred and the Shimmering Light Hub of Your True Self book. This is a really great book. And I liked it for many reasons, Robert, because the way it's broken down is really good. But what I love, at least from my own interpretation of what I read, is that you are this spiritual being. You've been practicing meditation and being in spiritual practices from a very young age. That's really who you are, as opposed to we live in this really busy world where meditation is a checklist item. It's a task, right? So it's like, if I meditate, then I'll be happier. If I journal, then that will help me be less stressed. And so it's you know, still in this cultural thing, we're meditating and journaling, but it's not effective because it's not a checklist item. It's like a way of being. It's like you're saying. How amazing that you've been in this type of discovery and self-discovery your entire life versus someone like myself has come into it after nearly dying and going into
What was that? If you don't mind my saying, I don't want to hijack it, but I read that on your site somewhere. What was that? Can you say, or would you rather?
Mine was actually a perfect storm of many things. Of what really physically took me down was heavy metal poisoning, high mercury poisoning. My brain was completely inflamed. I lost my ability to talk. My organs started shutting down. So I was seriously sick at the same time from so much childhood trauma. I actually had a mental break at the same time. So I went through this horrific, very dark period. Someone that just positive thought my entire life. And so it was just, I had a year of going through hell, but I had to discover who I was. The same thing. I had to get outside of the meds people were describing or what the doctors were telling me or all these things. And it was a spiritual journey of 12 months of self-discovery of who the fuck am I and why am I here? And it was the worst thing that ever happened to me and the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. But that was, and you had a series of things. I was getting better after 3 years, then the tumors came back. And then when I was getting better from that, then I had a stroke, which hospitalized me for 5 days. So, you know, and it's like, and then finally, I have no idea what's next. I'm doing great now. But I loved how you characterized it. It isn't cancer or toxic poisoning. It's, hello, something unexpected. Mm-hmm. How are you going to respond? It's a wake up. And to me, how you responded, how I responded, different than how your father responded, with all due respect, in elevating the doctor, but is really the whole game with all that, you know. And it is very much a spiritual journey, which I think everyone is on, because everyone, I believe, wants to know fundamentally, well, who am I? How can I live an authentic life? You know, where is my freedom to create and to be and to express? You know, and cancer for me catalyzed, even though it was 100% commitment to that lifestyle, it just said, not enough. You know, you think every day for 50 years is heroic? You're just a pussy. Mm-hmm. Now get going.
Right.
Get, you know. And I said, okay, I don't know how else to do anything. But then this other thing came and took me, maybe just because of my willingness. And
Getting out of the noise too. So again, there's just this life of Everybody's an expert. Everybody has an opinion. There's always something to do. Everything's a checklist. It's just go, go, go. Everybody's so fucking stressed out all the time. There's no time to get to that place. Whatever that place is we're referring to, you can't do it in this frenetic energy. You can't do it when it's everything's back to back to back. You can't do it.
No.
You can't, I mean, it's just, it's impossible. And yet we think, oh, if we go to a meditation class or we take yoga class or whatever, then that might solve the thing. And it's like, but no, it's not that.
It's useful. I don't do it, but you know, to me, I used to be a mystic. When I was younger, now I'm a pragmatist. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of, you know, I'm like, hey, do what works. If being less anxious, more focused, more able to connect because of yoga, meditation, jogging, juice, do it.
Yes.
I put in a whole life, and it took the last 5 years to get me somewhere that I have never even, couldn't even have imagined actually getting to. So, you know, you didn't get to where you are in your industry as a hobby every few days, check into the office. My guess is you worked your ass off. Mm-hmm. I mean, you worked your ass off smartly, but you just put in more time, focus, energy, commitment than probably everybody else you know. I like to think that's how I've done things. You know, for me, it's not competitive, but I was on it my whole life from the time I was 11. But even still, it was only when this thing came and got me. So I'm just going to reinforce your point, which is whatever in cancer, out of cancer, in relation, you got to make things important, both beyond language and in language. That is, it isn't something you prioritize and strategize. I had a coaching session with a guy whose wife just had her second child, 6 weeks old, the baby. And I've coached her and him. And they're in another country, so no one will know who they are. So he's going, Robert, there are some things I want to talk about today. One of them is I need to prioritize how to be more supportive to my wife for this, this, and this. She's stressed. She's taking care of a four-year-old, a six-week-old. I'm gone with it. How do I prioritize helping her? Fair question. Sincere. He loves her. I get it. But I said, is there anything in your life that you have to do? You don't prioritize, work doesn't get in the way, you don't, like you just, to ask, how do I prioritize doing that would make you laugh. What is that? Well, he comes back with the right thing, which is, well, my breathing is, it's like, that's non-negotiable. I said, okay, you need to make supporting your wife the same in your life as breathing. It is not something you prioritize. It is not something you trade off about. It is not something that is absolutely whacked thinking. You're breathing and you're supporting your wife in whatever terms she wants is now one thing that you do. I want you to go and tell her that. And if you don't, do not ever call me again. I just got like, we need to do that. We need to make things, and you don't get to where you are. You know, I looked at your site and everything, and I'm going, you know, good for her. But you don't get there by accident. You don't get there by going, that's good enough. You don't get there by going, well, I know I should do that, but I want to go and rollers. It takes sacrifice, commitment, effort, energy, focus, more commitment, more love, more devotion. We need to live like that. Mm-hmm. Cancer, no cancer. We need to live like that, from that state in which you do not ask how you can prioritize taking care of your wife.
I was going to say that. It's like the wrong question.
It's the absolute, well, to me,
that is the wrong question.
Don't ask me that. But it's basically the same thing, no matter what, which is sort of where the beyond language is. That's, I think, where we find what that focus and direction and purpose is. Then we bring it into existence with language and behavior, right?
You're exactly right on. Well, we are almost approaching our time together. So there's a couple things you and I can just talk. And I'd love to bring you back on for a couple. Anytime. We're going to talk this love thing, and we're going to talk about going to this place.
I'll come to Austin, do a program.
Well, we, okay. I'm Why so excited. Not? We're doing it. We are doing it. So a couple things. Okay. One, like what you said, like with this book of yours that I really liked, you know, there's a lot of spiritual books and woo-woo and people, it seems like, are even going off on this deep end. And I don't know if you watch J.P. Sears, but he has this great book where he just really makes fun of this quest to spirituality. It's almost turned into superiority. If I meditate or I yoga or I this, I'm just so much spiritual than you are, Robert, because I do it better than you do, or I do it more often than you do. And it's just so funny. You will love him. I will send you the link to his book because you're going to crack please. Up, right? And he's and what his one of his quotes is that I lost myself in this quest of trying to find myself according to all these gurus and the latest cultural dogma. And yet at the same time, he's very spiritual. Like he's a comedian. I think you'd love him.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good,
yeah.
Good.
So, but you know, it's just what I love about your book, to get back to that, is that it's just pragmatic, yet it's very spiritual at the same time, but it's not woo-woo. It's not this way out there. It's just sort of these simple maxims or axioms or principles that you've discovered to come across. You did have this opportunity to study under who you studied for, you know, your own spiritual quest. Yeah. And it's just, I think it's a really great book, breaking things down. Like, what is happiness? Is people are searching for happiness. Like, you can't go search and find happiness. It's not out there somewhere, right? Again, and, you know, happiness refers to a state of being that occurs automatically in the absence of self-concern. This happiness is not achieved. You know, I have it underlined here. And, you know, things like that where I think you just say sort of these big concepts that are, quote unquote, put in this spiritual context, but you just bring them down. I know you're a spiritual man, but you're very pragmatic and grounded and just doing your own work and putting it in language that maybe can help people have a better understanding of what they're trying to experience versus when people use the word achieve or get to or task, it's experience and it's beyond language. Again, experiences are very difficult to explain. This feeling of love now I have this feeling of friendship with you and wanting to know you and I want you to come to Austin, but how do I describe in language this that I'm feeling right now? Like, you can't, right? But if I weren't present with you right here, we didn't take the time to have this conversation and just see where it goes, we'd be missing this experience.
But you are. Here's the thing. Sorry, I know we're at the end of our time and all that. In speaking, there's what we say and how we say it. What we say is the content, the message. How we say it includes verbal, the words I use, vocal, you know, all the different ways in which we express it, and then there's the visual, what people say. So when we want to express linguistically within the context of public speaking something beyond words, we do it with the light in our eyes, with the smile, with holding someone's hand, with... That's how you do it. That is communicating. When we look at someone, you're in real estate. I'm sure people approach you, if not you personally, then generically, real estate, car salesman. Okay, she's going to be full of shit. And, you know, I can't believe anything she says. I'm going to come to you with that. You can't talk them out of that, but you can do exactly what you're doing now. Your eyes are present. There's a light in them. You have a smile, you're connecting, you're listening, you're open. You're like, of course I believe you. You're not saying anything, but that's part of, I think we want to be able to use that. And sometimes, no, I can't, I don't, there's no words, but I'm just going to, I love you. I just, whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever that is, exactly. Whatever it is,
I don't know, but okay.
Exactly. Well, so love the
Thank
book. And I do a, you know, reasonable amount of speaking. I used to do a lot of speaking before I got sick, then I really stopped. Yeah. And then I'm just getting back to that. But it's funny, I do get on stage, I could be rehearsed or whatever, but I just transcend to another place. And I'm off stage and people, I don't remember what I said half the time. So, and you know, and all the people that hire me say, okay, we want you to hit these three topics or these PowerPoint slides. And I fulfill on that, but I'm just, who knows what's going to come out of me. But so anyway.
Yes. Beautiful.
So one other thing, and this might be another future conversation as well, because
Love to.
Speaking, you know, and I know this book is a lot about your public speaking and helping people learn to speak authentically. And yes. That's what you do as a living and coach and train in that. And I'm going to call you offline because I think you can probably help me because this is a big part of what I want to get better at.
Okay.
But really, beyond that piece, it's really, again, the notion of the truth. And so much bullshit out there today. I mean, I just feel like I'm sifting through bullshit every day with all the marketing, with all the hyperbole, with all the experts, with all the gurus, with all the, I can help you with this. And we're being marketed to and advertised to. And it's like, who's being real and who isn't being real? And even in relationships, it's, you know, it's dodging, deflecting, passive aggressive.
Yeah,
like, where's the fucking truth? Like, why can't we just tell the truth? And I try to tell the truth, and my God, I might as well get shot. And I'm like, why does nobody want the truth?
Oh my
God. Some form of the truth, or at least, you know, I can say this is my truth, but my God, if you say something truthful, you're going to get an arrow or a bullet through your head. Yeah. So anyway, I just really love, again, what you say. Speaking truthfully is profound, powerful, and daring. It's so daring, isn't it? It takes courage to be honest, to tell the truth.
Absolutely.
And everybody, especially in our political environment now, everybody's afraid to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And it's just this daring style of authentic self-expression, communicating based on self-awareness, honesty, transparency, integrity, vulnerability, and connection.
Thank you.
It's essential philosophy and fundamental tenet is you are the message. And our speaking is our life. You're right. And it's no use walking anywhere to preach unless our walking is our preaching. But it's just truth. I mean, true authenticity is, you know, say what we mean what we say, and live in that truth. But it's also having the courage to tell the truth, even in a relationship. And that's part of the promise, you know, my partner and I have is that's it. It's like sometimes there can be some hurt feelings, but it's never attacked. But how can we ever grow together or beyond if we're not willing to suffer a little bit, to suffer through the truth? To get to the other side for some better outcome. But do you have anything to say about that? It's just this, we've lost this art of truth telling.
Christina, we have 3 minutes left and you're now asking me a question that is about
like
20 years of my work,
right.
30 articles, 2 books of my, yes, here's what I have to say.
Okay.
Go to my website, robertrabin.com, send me an email, and then I'll get back in touch with you. No, I mean,
well, let's have another conversation about the truth. Because
no, but
I think it's another thing that's missing.
Okay, let me drop one tiny piece in. I don't want to pretend like, you know, one size fits all. One of the reasons why telling the truth, telling our truth, this is what I think, this is what I feel, this is what I want, this is what I don't want, fundamental, basic level is, first of all, we have to know what that is.
Yes.
We have to get sort of into that place beyond language. Okay, that's one. But our entire socialization, for all of us, generational, racial, doesn't matter, is contrary to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's don't find out and don't express what's true. Do this, don't do that. So that's one thing. So just the notion of, first, do I know what my truth is in this moment? And secondly, by saying what it is, I'm literally pushing against my entire life's socialization. Then one of the things that does create a problem with it isn't that here's my truth. It's here's my truth and I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
Big difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I always, in my classes, I talk about it's better to be real than right. And so a lot of people bring an energy that is difficult to connect with when they say, here's my truth. This, it's not my opinion. It's the truth versus my truth.
Yep.
And so I have as many opinions as anybody about everything. Ask me, oh, here's my opinion. I never think I'm right, even in my area of expertise, public speaking. I'm not right, as in when I'm right, I close down to everything that's not in that rightness. I close down to anyone who doesn't agree with me. I can't learn beyond what I say is right and true, capital T. There's no game. So I go, this is my opinion, and I'm just trying to be real by disclosing who I am in this moment. I'm not right about anything. I'm not right. if you look at it, a lot of what gets in the way isn't people telling the truth, although that's hard enough as it is. It's they do it, but then I'm also right. They bring an energy of, and I'm right. And the only thing you can do with someone who's right is either agree with them or oppose them. There's no real connection.
Right.
So I'll just say that for now, but it's a very big subject. I've seen people grow more in a two-day class than in 20 years of meditation sitting, because the vulnerability of being seen by others triggers all of your insecurities. And when you grow in place beyond anything other than the ability to authentically connect and speak your truth in the midst of the greatest insecurities raging in your brain, in my view, you're getting pretty close to being free.
Well, let's close there, because that was beautifully said. So, Robert, thank you for your time. We could just go on for hours and hours. I feel very honored to have had this time with you.
Likewise.
So, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And we'll be putting in the show notes every place to get in touch with you. Your expertise is public speaking. A lot of my audience are working on that skill. So,
fantastic.
Myself included. But anyway, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Do me a favor very quickly. I don't know if we're off or not. Give your partner a big hug from a guy to a guy that says, dude, I dig you. You like your woman there and here. Can't wait to meet you. I love that.
I'm going to tell him that. He's going
That's
to
fantastic.
Yeah, and he's the best of the best. So
good.
All right, Robert. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
And so ends another episode of the Wealthy Wealthy Life podcast, where Christina brings you unconventional, cutting-edge strategies from leading experts to optimize your wealth and your health. As a token of gratitude for listening, go to fallingformoney.com and download a free copy of her best-selling book, Falling for Money. If you're ready to change your relationship with money, head on over to fallingformoney.com and download your free copy today.